Hello, and welcome to the inaugural edition of New Books in Systems and Cybernetics, a brand new channel here on the New Books Network. My name is Tom Scholt from the University of British Columbia. I'm your host. And first and foremost, I'd like to offer a big thank you to Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, for this fantastic opportunity to continue to promote, develop, and enliven the contemporary fields of systems and cybernetics. A great big thank you to Marshall for all the work he does, keeping this incredible academic community alive and through which I benefited tremendously as a listener for a very long time. And I'm so gratified and grateful to have a chance to be a host here. It's no secret that we continue to live in the midst of a digital revolution that continues to unfold in a rapidly accelerating fashion. Digital connectivity and the Internet of Things make possible not only smart homes, but smart cities. As with all technological revolutions, the road ahead is equally dotted with possibilities and potential pitfalls. Liz C. Werner and her colleagues at the Technical University of Berlin brought together a collection of thinkers and practitioners in the realms of architecture, design, and urban planning to wrestle with questions around ways we might utilize today's digital design tools to enable more responsive, resilient, and ultimately inclusive and democratic forms of urban design and governance without tipping the balance over to a technocratic project that might imprison us within its algorithmic logics. All of the contributors to this discussion share the hope that the insights of second-order cybernetics might provide valuable guidance as we attempt to find that particular sweet spot of human-machine interaction. Their insights are gathered together in Cybernetics State of the Art, edited by our guest, Liz C. Werner, and available free online from the Technical University of Berlin. As editor, Werner has skillfully crafted a dialectic arc that allows the productive tensions between digital utopianism and skepticism that enable a provocative investigation of the revolution that is happening, whether we like it or not, and might help us find the means to steer its emergence in ways that are most beneficial for all of us and our environment. A little bit about our guest, Liz C. Werner is principal of Tactile Architecture Office for Systems Architecture. She is assistant professor at Technical University Berlin for Computational Architecture and Sustainable Urban Design. Her research is driven by cybernetic principles and engages with architecture and digital theory. Between 2003 and 2016, Werner acted as design studio master and lecturer at the universities of Nottingham and Dessau, as a guest professor at Carnegie Mellon and Taylor's University, Malaysia. And she's lectured internationally and acted as a critic at such institutions as MIT, USC, Bauhaus University Weimar, Cooper Union, and Technical University of Darmstadt. And her design office, Tactile Architecture, actually received a German Enterprise Award for Best Modern Urban Architecture and Design Office in 2017. So in addition to being an accomplished academic, Dr. Werner is also an established and well-recognized practitioner. And so, without any further ado, let's turn to the interview. And let's say hello to our guest here on our first ever edition of New Books in Systems and Cybernetics. I am very pleased to have with us Professor Liz C. Werner from the Technical University of Berlin. Hello, Liz.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. I'm very happy to be talking to you about this exciting new book. So since we are a channel on the New Books Network, we'll begin with the traditional opening question across the channel, which is, can you just tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your academic background, maybe your trajectory through academia and otherwise, and how you came to an engagement with cybernetics?
Right. Yeah. Thank you, Tom, for that question. And thanks for having me. It's a real honor to do this sort of not just internet, but also intercontinental knowledge transfer, which I think is very much along the lines of cybernetics. Now, I'm an architect by trade. I actually started as a draftsman in Germany in Hamburg, and then went to the UK to University of Westminster and also Australia, the Bartlett. Australia. RMIT, and then back to London, to the Bartlett, to study architecture and do my diploma and my master's. The issue of cybernetics, I think I came across that even before I knew that I came across that. is I was interested in the interaction between humans. I was interested in interdependency between architecture and biology. I wanted to know how things relate to each other, as living things and non-living things. And in about 2001, I remember, I came across Gordon Pask, who I suppose you're familiar with. Yeah, Gordon Pask, we will speak about him and his work over the course of the interview. He was a cybernetician, he was not an architect, but he spoke about interaction and he designed machines, I would say, which related the human to the machine. And it was all driven by something that in cybernetics we call conversation. A professor in the Bartlett, he was one of his students. And I didn't know that at that time. And I went up to him. His name was Ranulf Glanville, who then actually became my mentor, I would say. And I said, being a diploma student, I said, Ranulf, I'm interested in architecture and cybernetics. Without knowing what it actually means, of course. And he said, whoa, I thought I'm the only one. So here it was me thinking I'm the only person interested in architecture and cybernetics. And then there was Ranulf, who immediately got me into his sort of aura of just being there. And that's how it all started in terms of cybernetics and architecture. This is the second part, because the first part started when I remember my mom gave me a book when I was about 19 or 20, which was by Margaret Mead. And the cyberneticians within the crowd here may know Margaret Mead from her amazing work on anthropology and cybernetics. So it all started actually within the family and then, flourished in the last, let's say, 15 to 17 years.
That's fantastic. And you're all very lucky to have parents that give you a Margaret Mead book as a gift. That's a good environment to grow up in, I would guess. And the phrase, I thought I was the only one, is one that listeners will hear throughout the many episodes of this podcast to come, because that is usually the first phrase out of a cybernetician's mouth when they meet another one. And I'm hoping that this podcast will do much to continue to link people like you and I and many others that we know who are floating around thinking they're the only ones and all the different intersections between cybernetics and other disciplines. As you may know, and listeners will get to know over the coming months, my entry to cybernetics is through cybernetics and theater. So it's ability to speak in and with and around and inside so many traditional disciplines is sort of endless. So when we find each other, we definitely sort of light up and find ways to talk like we're doing now. So the book we're talking about is called Cybernetics State of the Art, which is a perfect title for our inaugural podcast. So we might as well dive in. It's also the first part of a first volume of a series that you are publishing online through the Technical University of Berlin. So can you tell us a little bit about the genesis of the book and the series and the book's place in the series? And I believe you've already got a second volume that's being put together. But so any background about how this series and this particular volume came to be?
This is wonderful to talk about the book, first of all, and the infrastructure around it. And of course, you're right. There is a second one that I'm planning. And there's also a third one that I'm planning. But you know how these things are. This, I would say, is kind of maybe part three or four in my cybernetic journey throughout the last two decades. And it came about when I am part of the Technical University as an assistant professor in the Institute of Architecture. I'm working together with Raoul Bunschoten. Raoul Bunschoten, he was a lecturer for architecture, a studio master at the Architectural Association for about 15 years, I believe, in the 80s and 90s. And he worked together with Gordon Pask. You see, we are coming back to Gordon Pask all the time. I started in his chair for sustainable urban planning and design in 2015, and we realized that there is a lot of crossovers and a lot of things that we would like to collect and gather in a conference or in a book series or something like this, to review and to preview cybernetics in the frame of architecture, in the frame of urban design and planning, within the influence of robotics, big data, the question if we take decisions or if we are taking decisions together with machines or artificial intelligences. So there was a lot to talk about, and we started thinking about a conference which was actually called Cybernetics State of the Art. Last June, as in 2016, June 2016. That was cybernetic state of the art. And then we said, well, this is so exciting. We have to carry on. And the book series, Conversations, engages not just with cybernetics as a very specific subject discipline or even science, but it deals with communication, exchange, conversation, and learning. It deals with complex systems and how we can sort of take them apart. So then we decided to do this book series, and Raoul Bunschoten and myself, we are co-editing the series, and I started with the first volume, which I edited as a bit as a result of the conference that we did in 2016, which is the first volume. And this first volume should sort of give us a kickstart in a few directions to remind ourselves what cybernetics and architecture can be. I have to say that these 200-something pages that we have here in the first volume, of course, is not enough. It's a very, very, very small fraction of what could be said and discussed. So, yeah, this is our starting point from which we go.
Well, it's incredibly exciting that you're one of the rare people who at this point has an institutional framework in which you can explore these questions, which is obviously tremendously exciting, I would imagine, not just for you, but for the rest of us, that this is cybernetics is not something you're being asked to sort of do off the side of your desk. It's something that's embedded in something that clearly your department and by extension, your institution is engaged in. So that's very exciting for all of us, I think. So clearly you've mentioned a couple things. This book is at the intersection, as cybernetics often is, between the living and non-living systems and how they interact with each other and conversations of learning, etc. The book talks a lot about smart cities, talks about the Internet of Things, ways through which technology, digital technology can be involved in design and architecture, city planning, et cetera, issues that have been interwoven with cybernetics for a long, long time. And against the backdrop, what seems to me to provide the backdrop for this whole enterprise, at least for me as a reader, and the way these various chapters speak to each other, is Project CyberSyn from the early 1970s in Chile, when Stafford Beer went and worked for the government of Salvador Allende and created a kind of the first large-scale cybernetic governance system, for lack of a better term. And of course, we're very fortunate to have a chapter in the book by Raul Espejo, who was one of the key people working on that project. And there is a sense of sort of CyberSyn diaspora that still works throughout the cybernetics community around the world, So it's a hugely ambitious project, and without too much detail, and there's lots of literature that we can point listeners to. Can you say a little bit about Project CyberSyn, what it was, and how it provides a kind of backdrop for a lot of the questions?
Thank you for the question. CyberSyn and also CyberFolk, which is kind of part of it, as you're saying correctly, it is a backdrop for the discussion or the debate on what cybernetics can do in society, what cybernetics can do for urban design and planning, how it is connected to participative procedures on all sorts of levels, not just the urban or the country or nationwide level, but also local levels and small scale, let's say, human social systems, since we also have social systems in other organizations such as ants or bees or fish or something like this. CyberSyn was a project that came about end of the 60s, beginning of the 1970s in Chile, as you're rightly saying. And it was based on a systemic understanding of trying to combine local agreements or local happiness in systems with global ones. The global ones here would be a production of things needed in a country, like food, for instance. And a CyberSyn with the operations room was led out in a way that along Chile, which we all know is a very long country, there was a system of, you may believe it or not, fax machines that had been wired up since the internet did not exist at that stage, and the predecessor, the ARPANET, was actually only meant for university institutions and the army. And there's a lot of literature on the history and the differences between internet, ARPANET, and so on. And CyberSyn was trying to understand how do things relate to each other. So in Chile, in Santiago de Chile, there was the operations room, which was physically, as a piece of design, very carefully done by, let me just remember, by Gaibán Siepe. That's right. As far as I remember, there is also a photograph in the book somewhere of the operations room. And we all may see that it has a little bit in common with Enterprise, Starship Enterprise. That's quite intriguing in a way. Now, CyberSyn had this one operations room, which is basically the brain, where all the information, today we would possibly say big data collection, came together. All the information of production systems in the country, of performance of machines and factories and so on, logistics, etc., and all this data came together into the operations room, where we had a few decision makers who would then react. So what was happening is that there were regulations, these regulations help the systems to work. The production systems data came back, what the performance is like, and based on that feedback, the next iteration of decisions would be taken. So we were working with, well, in that case, a closed cybernetic system, where production, economy, ecology, demographics, came together in one amazing room. And the idea was to have real-time information from the factories rather than having like reports once a year or twice a year. Now, the overriding or the driving issue for project, CyberSyn, was to be more democratic, to understand the country and all its agents as one organism that has to work together. I mean, Raul Espejo, he says the emphasis of CyberSyn anticipated a cybernetic argument that its time had to come. And today, with technological, methodological, and epistemological developments, this time is closer. So in that sense, social complexity nowadays would be a bit of a parallel to what the utopian project of CyberSyn was aiming to do.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to think of, imagine Stafford Beer today, you know, or Stafford Beer at your conference, for instance, with the kind of technological capacities we have now. It's an incredible story, and I would encourage listeners to read Stafford Beer's book, Brain of the Firm. The later edition has a great detail of the implementation of CyberSyn, and then Eden Medina's excellent book from a couple of years ago, Cybernetic Revolutionaries, where you can get, so you get an account from the inside, and then a kind of sympathetic, but still a critique from Eden Medina's book. It's an incredible story. And the fact that they pulled this off, not just that with what was available in the 70s, but with even less because of technology embargoes, et cetera, as governments hostile to the socialist Allende project were choking off as much as they could. So that what he patched together with his team, including Dr. Espejo, is truly remarkable.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, first of all, thinking about or having the desire to manage social and economic complexity and then using technology, which in a way didn't even exist in a political environment that did not necessarily nourish this attitude, was very brave. And I mean, it lasted for like 3 or 4 years. This ops room was destroyed. In fact, we do have very, very good information and writings about how this happened and how it was destroyed by Guy Bonsiepe. So what was a utopia, in fact, was a political, I would say, a political reality. And within the text that we see here from Raul Espejo, Raul talks a lot about the viable system model, which has five systems, and it has a complex relationship from one system to another. But interestingly, this viable system model is still being used, or actually it is actively being used in management of all sorts. Hence, we have already a relationship between architecture, regional management, or actually national management, policy making, and technology, which is very state of the art, I would say.
Absolutely. No, it's sort of the time has come, and it's very much alive in your book. So let's dive forward into these. We've talked a bit about the backdrop of it. So your particular chapter introduces the term cybernetification. Can you outline what this idea is for us? And clearly it's something engaging with some of the same questions. And also, you mentioned the utopian nature of the CyberSyn project. There's also, of course, some tensions in there and critiques and debates around democracy versus centralization, et cetera, which will also play out across some of the chapters we'll talk about. But I just want to sort of mark that for listeners. And maybe that will surface for us, you know, right now as we get into this question. But let's talk about your notion of cybernetification.
Yeah, cybernetification, it's, as the term sort of, well, it's not a noun, it's actually a verb. It's a bit like architecture. Cybernetification, the way I define it, has to do with the change or the increasing connectedness and interdependency between agents between, well, objects and between bits of information. When I talk about bits of information, of course, I'm talking about immaterial stuff. When I talk about cybernetification or the process of cybernetification, I'm trying to construct an organization between atom-based objects that carry information and bit-based, well, bits that also carry information. So I'm working on a construct that works with, well, let's call it the real stuff, the physical analog stuff, and the digital. I would say this is something that we are working on globally in what is called the technosphere, a term that has been floating about, at least in Germany for quite a while, and I think it's also in the United States where the technosphere is quite apparent. Of course, the Anthropocene. And another thing that is part of the cybernetification that I'm propagating is netgraft. Netgraft with a G rather than a C. It relates to grafting, like the art of grafting plants, for instance. So the cybernetification is a process that deals with the transition from purely material, atom-based material, to a conversation between atoms and bits. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. So, and when you say information, are you using a kind of Shannon model of information? Or what would your sort of working definition be of information as it's carried by both these atom-based and bit-based systems?
Well, I think Shannon is absolutely important to as a starting point. The Shannon model, of course, is a model of first order cybernetics, where there's an input and a process, and we also have this issue of noise. And then there is an output, and in the ideal case scenario, somebody who can decipher the information that goes from input to the other part towards the output. But the Shannon model does not account for feedback. It also does not account for things having a goal. So I'm working with a model that started with Gordon Pask's model, conversation theory, which was then moved forward by many cyberneticians, but I think the one who actually manifested it for many disciplines to understand is Paul Pangaro. And we're talking about goal-driven systems. So when I talk about cybernetification that combines or creates a conversation between atom-based information and bit-based information, I'm actually talking about something where these two things come together and give feedback to each other, but also can work by themselves. So the Shannon model has an input, a process, and an output. The model of second-order cybernetics has feedback, and it feeds back into the input, let's say that, as an iteration. Norbert Wiener was talking about feedback, which could be on one hand a reflex, but it could also be something where one can learn from. This is one part of it, and the other one has to do with variety, which means that an organism in different situations can have the ability to react differently.
And this takes us directly to, I would say, maybe an opportunity to talk about trivial machines versus non-trivial machines, initially identified by Hans von Forster, but I think is important to what you're talking about here as well, and why the Shannon model is insufficient on its own. So could you give the listeners just a brief idea about this distinction between trivial machines and non-trivial machines?
Well, the trivial machine is something like, let's say, I think the thermostat is a trivial machine, where basically you do have a sensor and you do have a heating system, and you also have an environment. And the sensor is regulated, or actually the heating system is regulated by the sensor, which feels the temperature. And the sensor then speaks to the heating system and says, turn on. As soon as the sensor realizes that the environment, that the air is warm enough, it would talk to the heating system again and say, turn off. So we do have a closed loop system where nothing changes, unless there is, of course, some kind of perturbation or disturbance that would change the program. But at that moment in time, nothing changes the system. So there would be a control of the heating system through one piece of information without having any relationship to the exterior or to the world outside of its boundaries. We could say that there's, in a way, a feedback, because the sensor would actually get information from the temperature in the room, but there's no feedback that would allow the system to learn or change.
And the non-trivial?
The non-trivial machine, in fact, is the development further. The non-trivial machine is something where you have an organization that wants to achieve a goal, and it may be able to adjust, and it may be able to also collect experience in order to develop further.
And so that the state that the organism is in, or that, sorry, the system is in, is going to dictate to some degree, is going to influence the output. So that's not just the simple input output, but there's input meets the state of the.
That's right.
Is that correct?
That's right. So if we are, let's say, if you look at the Ford model of production systems, car factories, you would have an information. This is how you put a car together. And on the other side, there would be a car coming out of it. And that would happen over and over and over again. But of course, in a car factory, and we did have the case, in fact, there's the question of how does the worker put the car together? What is the influence of this particular operation to the human body? What is the influence of the performance of the car to the next iteration of the design? What is the interdependency between the material used to the environment, as in sustainability? So these things are not considered in a trivial machine, or also in a, let's call it, first order cybernetics, because I think this is one thing that needs to be mentioned, that there is a first order cybernetics and a second order, whereas in the first order, one would observe a system and look what it does. A bit like the hard sciences look at their specimens and their projects, like biology, mathematics, physics, and so on. A second order cybernetics would include the person that observes into the system. So as soon as you figure out something in the system, you look at and you realize, aha, things are going differently than I was thinking, you would change and steer and react and adapt, and you would learn.
And of course, in your Ford example, then there's labor relations, there's interpersonal dynamics and all those really non-trivial things that are at the heart of this grafting that you're talking about as well, where we've got information systems and data and we've got people, perhaps the most non-trivial machine that we engage with every day, which are, of course, notoriously difficult to predict, as the social sciences have grappled with for so long. That's great. Thank you. So a phrase that leaps out from one of the chapters in the book from Tim Jackna is, he says, we need to design learning processes rather than master plans. And I'm responding to what you've been saying about learning and about conversation between these different systems that are grafted together so that it's not input, output. There is goal, but there is learning. There is recursion and all of these things that cyberneticians deal with and try and draw our attention to. So I just wanted to throw that. That's one of my favorite quotes in the book that that resonates with what you were just talking about. You declare in your chapter that architecture is globally at a time of crisis, in that we are not sure how to define architecture, and we certainly were not sure about what the practice of architecture actually does or how to educate our architecture students, contemporary and in future. Can you describe this crisis that you're mentioning a little bit and some of its potential ramifications if we don't find a way to find our way through these questions?
Well, I think I'm only one of many who are currently sort of a little bit struggling with what architecture is. And as an educator, and I've been doing that for about, 14 years or so, I'm of course very interested in what our future architects are doing and how I can, or how we as architectural educators can design our curricula and can equip our students with knowledge on one hand, skills on the other, but also a certain sensitivity towards what they are actually doing. Now, what I realize is, what I've been realizing for a while, is that in many cases, architects, first of all, have a huge issue with policies, with regulations, with all the rules that we have to, obey in a way to build something. It starts with energy saving. That results in, buildings that have hardly windows, since walls are better insulators. And it also, in terms of fire regulations, results in rather small spaces. And there's no celebration of the staircase anymore. Let's say that. Take just this as an example. The staircase is a connector between two vertical spaces, and once it's open, I can see what's going on. I can feel that there is a horizontal and a vertical movement. So the other thing is that one thing is that we have to obey a lot of rules and regulations. The other thing is that it is very hard legally to become an architect and to run an office and, in fact, also to make enough money to survive. So this is one issue which is like the general, external component. Internally, if you think about it, I mean, like 20 years ago, I think it's about 20 years ago when I started as a draftsman, we started with rapidographs. Rapidographs are basically ink pens and pencils. Computers didn't exist, in fact, in offices. We just started to have computers. We did blueprints. I mean, my first job was to actually be in a basement and do blueprints, like proper copies of A0s. Now, 20 years later, our language has, or our notation system, let's say that, is moving from lines to code. So from drawing lines to writing code, This is a development which is there. We are also working with digital craftsmanship. We are programming robots. We are looking into textures and tectonics and those things of buildings, but we have not implemented that within the architectural education. We do receive students in the master courses that are not aware of 3D modeling software. And this is alarming. If you look at the car industry, they have moved much, much quicker. If you look at the building industry, we are putting a brick on top of another. So I don't have anything against bricks. I think they're absolutely beautiful. I mean, you know, environmentally friendly, they store the energy, they have a beautiful feel, absolutely wonderful material. But how do we deal with these materials? Another thing is a systemic understanding. A while ago, I said, well, the architect is not a designer of objects. The architect is a designer of systems and complex relationships. But if you look at first, second, third, fourth, and fifth year final presentations, in many cases, you see an object on an A0. And you ask about the relationship of this object, this building, within its social, demographic, urban, tectonic, climatic context. And usually there may be an answer, but the answer in many cases may not have been a primary driver for the design proposition. So we are at the moment in 2017, in fact, suggesting, when I say we, it's these architects who deal with the digital stuff, we suggest that we are even beyond a second digital turn. And I see students in master courses who don't even know how to 3D model it with a computer. So this is where I think we are in a crisis, because we are not moving fast enough. I have a big problem trying to teach the students, or actually to excite the students to work with microprocessors, to work with things that, you know, kinetic architectures and so on, which is super exciting stuff. Because the condition is still a square box, which could be beautiful though.
So if I'm hearing you right, there's many dimensions, but I'm hearing two sort of strands here. One when I say simply, I don't mean simply, but I mean is the idea of the execution, the ability to execute and not fall behind in terms of processes that the digitized world enables. And you mentioned building being far behind other fields of design. But that there's also and what I think is at the center of this book are the social, ethical implications of understanding this distinction you make between designing systems with complex components and multi-layered relationships versus designing discrete objects and matter, and that it's that networked and ultimately social embeddedness of design with all of its ethical implications. So it's not just, hey, we need to use computers because computers are cool and they're fast and whatever. It's that they're going to enable. Ironically, people sometimes see technology, and this is again getting back to things that are at the core of debates, ongoing debates about cyber sin. People fear technology as something that's going to imprison us in a kind of algorithmic deterministic reality, when in fact, I sense what you and like-minded colleagues are about trying to use the potential for the flows that these can create to understand these social networks and try and steer them, which is ultimately, of course, what cybernetics is, in a more democratic and healthy manner. Is that true?
Well, I don't know if it's true, since I'm not a big believer in reality or truth.
Okay, right, yeah.
I would like to refer to Heinz von Förster here. I think it's definitely true what you're saying in terms of how I'm thinking.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I use the word true. Yeah. Am I correctly understanding you? I, as a second order cybernetician, I'm well aware I need to be more careful with my use of that T word.
I know, it's terrible, isn't it, when cyberneticians talk to each other? It's just so much fun. let me get back to this beautiful red thread. Absolutely. I totally agree with what you're saying. I don't think we have a problem, and I don't think it's incredibly beautiful to have technology. But the first question, and this is something that Gilbert Simondon was engaging with in the mode of existence in technical objects, which apparently was written in 58. In French, it was then translated in English in 1980. And the first question is, what is technology? Or what is nature? Because the fear that, you know, technology would take over, that has always been something within the human existence. But if you're saying, well, there's not a difference between the technology of, you know, the thing in a computer and nature or what we're doing, when you say, well, this is actually part of us, this is part of humankind, and this is part of our natural evolution, I think then things become a lot more simple. So when we talk about this systemic understanding or the social technical ecology through the lens of technology is nature, is culture, and so on, we could work with understanding where we are going much, much, much easier. So that also would mean in terms of architecture and architectural education or architectural production. Well, education, it could mean being able to change curricula quicker. In terms of architectural production, it could mean, well, let's try industrial production, modular components. Let's see if we can get feedback from the people who use the buildings into the design process for the next iteration.
And then, of course, what rears its head always is power and politics. And that these processes and this kind of net grafting, and, you know, you go back to CyberSyn, et cetera, they always take place inside a particular political climate or political environment. And so there's that pull between the more utopian sense of the kind of participatory, egalitarian, emergent kind of governance that rises up from the people in these recursive sort of levels. And then the idea, though, that, you know, CyberSyn, eventually there's that ops room, and that we're each of these systems at some point, as I understand them, are going to agree on a certain set of indicators that are going to guide, we're going to use as the key feedback, even the decision of which indicators are the ones we need to pay attention to. I know this is what we're going to spend the rest of our lives grappling with, but can you tell me a little bit about your own sense of that struggle between the kinds of liberating possibilities and, you know, just we always have to face head on the critique that really what at the end of the day, this is a kind of technocratic project in which there's still those people that decide which indicators are the ones that count. What is the most important feedback? And because it seems to pull in these radically different directions. Where if you read Stafford Beer talking about CyberSyn, you see this is great. It's going to be all about the people, and Allende as well. And then these critiques saying, "Oh, it's so utterly centralized, technocratic kind of process." So how do we navigate those pitfalls and those traps?
This is a great question. I think I should become a politician when I answer that.
Yeah. Well, I think this is the thing we can't avoid, right? Ultimately. And I mean, the question I end up asking is, I'm going to go right on the limb here and say, how far can these things even be taken within a capitalist framework?
It depends on who takes the decisions. Now, this is incredibly hard, of course, to answer.
Yes, I know I'm throwing you right into the
But let me try. Well, I think there's many things that have to be done. I mean, if you look at the very kind of, you know, very basic way of living in, let's say, an urban environment, since we are really sort of, there's a trend to go towards living in urban environments rather than rural environments. Let's start with small things. Let's talk about infrastructure, I mean, like mobility within a city. Once you're mobile, you do have the possibility to gain knowledge about where you live or who lives there. You also gain the possibility to go to work, to go to your, you know, places for leisure. You go out and so on. So the issue of mobility within a city is absolutely crucial for interaction between, well, the people in the city. So one of the suggestions I would have is let's have free mobility within urban spaces for everybody. That on one hand is the public transport, meaning subways, buses, and so on. But it could also be, well, let's call it also public transport. It could also be e-mobility that is free to share. So, because I think once you give people more possibilities to interact with, their folks, it might be easier to gain trust. Do you know what I mean? I think it's very much on trust, how things work. Because honestly, what we learn about participatory processes, I think we are pretty far away from participatory design process in urban environments to really be considered.
Or even going back to participatory education systems, so, you know, that it starts, that we become inculcated in a participatory kind of culture, as opposed to, you know, we still so much of the sort of banking model of education where you sit there and the expert will deposit this expertise into you, as opposed to co-constructing knowledge together in a more constructivist kind of education.
Absolutely. I mean, this is like the, you know, when I talk to my students and I say, we are following one very important principle, and that is called teach back. So I teach you, you teach me. With designers and architects and art students, that works well. With students from project management or human resource management, it doesn't work at all, because they do expect that the teacher or the professor tells them what is right and what is not right, whereas the design-based students love it. And by doing this, I realized that the outcomes of the studios that I'm running are a lot better, and students remember much better than as if I would tell them what is right or wrong. So coming back to this mobility issue, if we start having more, let's call it interactive mobility, and interaction, I suppose you can trigger by making it for free or actually paying it through tax, let's say that, we could have a bit of a better city in many instances.
And one of the many things I love about this book is that these debates, this does not lapse into a kind of just utopianism of this kind. I mean, every single chapter, I mean, I think, for me, Raoul Bunschatten, your colleague, his chapter starts with the most sort of utopian notion of talking about the second skin of a city is a continuous city web spanning the earth, a thin layer of dynamic processes and the feedback loops between built things, houses, streets, infrastructure, and the way the city designer as a kind of curator. And it's a vision that I absolutely get very excited about. But even he says later, the contemporary smart city is both an ideal of interactive, hyper-efficient, intelligent support systems enhancing life, etc., but it can also be, and he calls it, a parasitic lair which preys upon its host, or even a virus which becomes even more powerful, a plague nearly impossible to evade. And so when we teach the basics of urban design, what do we teach is the great question that he asks. And you brought up this notion of trust, right? These kinds of processes seem to me to ultimately require a kind of trust undergirding them, that we can go into this kind of idea of a learning process rather than a master plan, and that these feedback loops are going to allow something. I mean, I think in a sense it goes right back to the definition of cybernetics when Norbert Wiener put the word control in it. People got afraid. And it's a different notion of control, right? And it's not about controlling others, but navigating a kind of stability.
That's right. And this is great conversations that Raoul and I have. And we do have this ongoing debate because he favors the term conscious city. So not smart city, conscious city. The conscious city also includes the human being, human feedback as a driver for learning for the smart city. So only through the human feedback, the smart city becomes intelligent and conscious, and these networks between, you know, the human network and the, let's call it, a digital intelligent network can work together. And I, on the other hand, say, I think it's the unconscious city and not the conscious city, because we would like to have a city that also takes unconscious decisions rather than conscious decisions. So it's a bit of a terminology thing that we're dealing with. But of course, he hits the nail on the head by sort of thriving these utopian ideas in a way. But again, you know, going back to the moments where electricity was discovered, or he talks about cyborgs and hyper reality. So when you read the chapters together, like Raoul Bunschoten's chapter and my chapter, they talk about the same thing. One is about the smart or conscious city, and the other one is more about the relationship between the human and the robotic. Raoul is working on the urban scale, and I'm working on the architectural scale and on a cybernetic meta level. And this is also the reason actually why we're working on this book series, because it kind of, you know, works together.
This dialectic at the core of all of this is really important. And I think it's Delphina van Dittmar's chapter where she's talking about, you know, she zeroes in on what some of the issues to be grappled with around, because obviously we're talking about things that are already here, right? The Internet of Things, smart homes, you know, my son got a Google Mini for he's 11 years old and he desperately wanted a Google Home, right? So that he can talk to Google and get it to do things for him. Yeah, and it's great. But there's this idea that she says, smart market often envisions the user's upgraded life under principles such as productivity, security, efficiency, optimization, convenience, and automation, which none of those are inherently bad things, but they tend to be a group of very sort of marketplace, market-driven, sort of capitalist efficiency kinds of things. And she then later on talks about shifting that into something that becomes more about possibility and creativity than necessarily simply efficiency and productivity. So what's your take on that? That dichotomy.
I think this is totally logical in a way. I don't see a dichotomy here. I would sort of go back to to the times, you know, so the times of needlework, let's say that. Because basically, yes, you're absolutely right. This thing is market driven. There's, you know, a handful of people who earn an enormous amount of money by us using that. I mean, I just sort of renamed my robot Hoover to Henry because that gives me a more sort of, you know, close relationship to my Hoover. Totally crazy. But what happens here is, on one hand, it's market driven, it's capitalist, you know, it may also have issues of cybersecurity and data protection acts and things like that. But on the other hand, we do have an enormous amount of open source platforms. We have GitHub, we have processing.org. In fact, we also have YouTube. The microprocessors, controllers, all those things are relatively cheap, even a 3D printer. So what is happening here is, I think that we are, on one hand, able to, of course, use Google and so on and pay with our data, but on the other hand, receive possibilities, and I think this is also what Delfina is talking about, receive the possibilities to be able to use those devices, to use those parts and kits of parts to enhance our lives in the way we want. It may not be our generation or, you know, the older generation or the kids who are like, you know, 27, but it may be the generation that has been born 5 years ago. I mean, like my very good friend, she's a media architect and she teaches coding for girls between 6 and 10. So these kids use code, open source, interconnectivity, the Internet of Things natively, a bit like, you know, we use, you know, our granddad's hammer or our grandma's, you know, needlework bits and pieces. So I think it gives us an enormous opportunity. I mean, you know, we can 3D print prosthetics if we have to. I mean, physical prosthetics for, you know, arms or something else. And this is liberating. And of course, you pay with something. You know, nothing is for free.
There's no free lunch, as they say.
There's no free lunch. You know, even life, you pay with death. Or was the other way around? You pay death with life. But I wouldn't be afraid of that. You know, it's a matter of attitude. And I think if you go through the world as a learning person, as somebody who's sort of curious and aware that things are changing, it could be pretty good, you know. And if you think realistically, we have a society that is getting increasingly old. Like we've got more elderly people living at home by themselves than we used to have. And these technologies that are currently being developed also within architecture and we are working on intelligent building components, for instance, will hopefully be used in a positive way to help elderly, for instance, or people who cannot move around their own home freely by themselves. So I don't see an issue, despite of all cyber hacking and cyber criminality and ethical problems. I think we are on a very good way, actually.
And I would suggest, and this is a way of bringing us to sort of, as we draw to a close here, you know, going back to this idea of second order cybernetics, because it seems that, you know, all of these things are possible, but the word cybernetics doesn't always turn up and people, in fact, seldom does, right? That's why we're having this conversation and, you know, starting this channel, et cetera, is to continue to keep these disciplinary ideas alive, is that the guiding principles of second order cybernetics versus simply first order cybernetics, so that it's not just a matter of efficiency, but it's a reflective learning. It's a learning process and not just a master plan. So to take us to the end here, can you tell us a little bit, just sort of final words for this conversation about why the cybernetic perspective, the second order cybernetic perspective, is at the core of this conversation and why it's important. And I'll just give you one more quote from Delfina, where she says, as opposed to the current linear directionality of algorithmic logic, second order cybernetics implies the extension of control as a mutual notion, since the controlling and the controlled elements of a system share a goal. So what is the most important thing about looking at this entire thing that's happening, you know, whether we like it or not? And you've given us a very, I think, optimistic position on it, which I understand. But that this second order perspective is something that we need to keep in our minds and keep conscious of if we're going to have this continue to unfold in a way that is the most beneficial.
Yes. Now, sort of to conclude this this conversation on second order cybernetics and learning, what has brought humankind to where we are now? Well, not just humankind. Let's say our whole, you know, spaceship Earth is difference. We are different from our environment. One person is different from another. And through understanding our goals and the differences we have with others, we start working on moving forward. And I think those differences, understanding the differences, allow us to, well, to sort of, you know, rub against each other and to understand who has which goal. And by understanding those goals and the parameters that come with it, we have the possibilities, and we need to take this possibility to move and to follow our goal. And the nice thing with cybernetics is that on the way, you may realize that what you considered as your primary goal is not so relevant anymore. So we talked about teaching earlier, and at one stage pedagogy realized that it could be interesting if the pupils or the students bring in their own ideas. So the second order cybernetics, where we can address human complexity as something that is difficult to understand, but that is necessary to take, we go much further than just treating everything or everybody the same. And variety gives us the opportunity to survive in many situations. So if we embrace complexity, if we embrace variety, if we embrace different opinions and attitudes and different goals, we have the opportunity to survive many different situations. And this is going back to Ashby's law of requisite variety, which he developed in Design for a Brain in the 1960s, which I highly recommend to read. So, yes, I think variety and complexity need to be understood in order to thrive, rather than to stick or to stay in a sort of biological homeostat where everything is repetitive without reflection.
That's great. That's a beautiful way to frame this as a something that's not a project about streamlining and eliding difference, but in fact allowing that complexity to be that's what's going to make us robust and resilient. Beautiful. Thank you. So our traditional last question, and I know you're such a busy dedicated artist, practitioner, academic, that this could be another hour conversation, but what are you working on now?
Uh-oh. Which project do you want to hear?
Tell us about the slime. Can we hear about the slime, or is that still too early?
That may be a little bit too early, but it is within a larger framework, and it also relates, of course, to cybernetics. Well, there is this fusarium. This is what it's called. It's an organism. It's a multicellular kind of membraney organism, and it's called slime mold. And well, it was discovered a long time ago, but it had been rediscovered in about 2000 in order to understand its intelligence. It is part of what people are working on in the unconventional computing world when it comes to biological computers. And it is something that within architecture, a very small group of people are working on when it comes to also pattern making, because this creature, it grows, and it grows and it looks like the growing of branches of trees. And then it grows into another pattern, which looks a little bit like the skin of a giraffe. And it changes. So it has a certain morphology in its patterning, which of course we are very interested in as architects who are trying to envisage and design in a way biologically working buildings and also biologically working urban organisms. So the larger subject would be how to actually learn from intelligent biological material and to implement this into architecture. This is sort of the most kind of, you know, out there project. On a more domestic paradigm, in TU Berlin, we are working on a building component which has integrated intelligence, which also has material behavior, so that it reacts to the sun, that it can collect fine dust, that it can also be prefabricated industrially, and that is sort of the down-to-earth building project that we are working together with engineers and also Aalto University and other partners. And that's an EU-funded project, and we are very grateful that we can combine some of the cybernetic issues with building and start working on cyber-physical building components. And the slime mold is more a cyber-biological physical component.
That is so exciting. And that work also goes right back to Pask and Ashby and others, right, who were all, you know, even in the earlier days of cybernetics, this idea of biological computing and these learning organisms and so overlapping with ideas of biomimicry, but it's about more than that. But this idea that their adaptive processes are something that could be valuable for us.
Absolutely. I mean, whatever I'm working on, and I think this is the same with all cyberneticians working sort of in, let's call it, the real world, we have to be careful that when we talk to non-cyberneticians, that we don't use the word cybernetics, because there's different connotations in different cultures, different countries, and different disciplines. So we better don't use that. But you are absolutely right, especially the slime mold project and the biological computing goes back to a very concrete project by Gordon Pask. There's a beautiful article. It's called Growing an Ear. And it's about the biological computer that was used for Musicolor. But, I mean, this is a different sort of, you know, conversation. Yes, I have learned a lot from you know, studying those principles, not just from the 20th century, but much earlier, the 19th century, about biology and biological organisms and environment, the predecessors of, well, cybernetics in a way. So, and it's super exciting, but as I said, there's also a danger to get lost into in all these things.
Well, I'm hoping this channel will do something to help lift the veil and make the world safe for the word cybernetics again. And you're certainly playing a vital role in doing that. And we've ended right where we began with atoms meeting bits, right, in this discussion of the slime mold. So thank you so much, Liz. We've been talking to Liz C. Werner from the Technical University of Berlin about her new book, Conversations, Volume 1, Cybernetics, State of the Art. And it is available free online, right? Can you let us know how we access that? What's the, we can add something in the show notes, I think.
You can actually, it's free online. This is something that TU Berlin does, and we are very grateful for that. Well, you can just basically Google the book's name and TU Berlin. You can also look into my Google Scholar profile. It's in there. But you can also order it in the U.S. We do have one channel that delivers to the U.S. It's not TU Berlin, but they are called jpc.com, I think. And you can order the physical book if you would like to have that and touch it and feel it and, you know, put your markers in there. But sure, it's free online. That's also one of the sort of cybernetics attitudes that we are trying to share knowledge to receive feedback.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. Well, thank you again so much. I couldn't have imagined a better, more appropriate guest for our first edition of New Books and Systems in Cybernetics. And thank you so much for talking with us. And I'm sure we'll get another chance to talk again soon.